the invitation, and maybe more importantly, for the courage to organize an in-person talk, in-person meeting. And I'm very sorry that I wasn't able to make it in person. We have a one-year-old son at home. Both my wife and I are teaching, so I couldn't find a way to make it work. And so I'm afraid I'm putting you through another Zoom talk, but I hope it'll be okay. And so then I was asked to talk about the cosmological stochastic gravitational wave background. And I'll start by showing this line, but you shouldn't worry. I won't really tell you about the cosmic evolution of our universe. I'm just using this slide to highlight the kind of sources that I will be talking about. I'll start on the very left, and I'll talk about inflation, where we know that we have one of the famous prediction from inflation that there should be a stochastic gravitational wave background just from the quantum fluctuations in the metric. Then I'll briefly talk a little bit about processes that happen at the end of inflation, which also generate gravitational waves. And in principle, we'll see whether those are detectable, or it doesn't seem like they're detectable without spoiling it too much, but the physics is quite interesting. Then I'll make my way down in energies or forward in time, and say a few words about first order phase transitions, which are an interesting target for the various instruments, ranging both from phase transitions relevant for the axion, relevant maybe to leptogenesis, to the more obvious electroweak phase transition and QCD phase transition, which unfortunately in the standard model are second order and don't lead to any gravitational waves, but departures from the extensions of the beyond the standard model could lead to first order phase transitions that one can probe and test. And then I'll talk a little bit about defects that might be left over from phase transitions. In that case, it doesn't really matter if they're first or second order. We'll talk just about the defects. And then I'll talk a little bit about using gravitational wave background going further into the future, where it has been detected as a background source, because these gravitational waves really probe the entire expansion history of the universe. And so there are a lot of features in the gravitational wave background that are quite interesting and, certainly too small to be detected now, but still fun to think about, I think. And so you should just interrupt me with any questions, obviously, but for now, let me start with inflation. And here I'm again assuming that everyone is familiar at some level with inflation. I'm just showing this as a reminder to make sure we're all on the same page. So the simplest model that we can write down that leads to a sufficiently long phase of inflation that also ends, that isn't just driven by a cosmological constant, is Einstein's theory of gravity or general relativity, minimally coupled to a scalar field with some potential. And then if the scalar field is nearly homogeneous and at a position in field space, so the potential energy density dominates the energy density, this leads to nearly exponential expansion as long as the first slow roll parameter or V prime over V is small enough. And it's sufficiently long if we also have the second slow roll parameter much smaller than one, which is V double prime over V in Planck units, much less than one. And this doesn't have to be a general statement about the potential overall. This could just be an inflection point, but one needs to have these kind of conditions, at least in the simplest model. One can go beyond that, consider trapped or warm inflation or some other scenarios, but this is the simplest picture. And the simplest models of inflation predict that the primordial fluctuations are dominated by density fluctuations, but that there is a subdominant contribution from gravitational waves. That's the one we'll be talking about. The density fluctuations are well approximated by a power law with some exponent that is usually called ns minus 1. Similarly, for the gravitational waves, there's some nt, so they're slightly different conventions, but it's the same idea. And we expect them to be nearly scale invariant, close to Gaussian, adiabatic. We expect the universe to be spatially flat, and this is all consistent with observations. To show that graphically, I'm showing you this figure here. So ns is the spectral index for the density perturbations that I just mentioned, and r is the tensor to scalar ratio, so just the ratio in the power of the tensor modes to the power in the scalar modes. And I'm showing you both the constraints here from the previous sets of experiments, WMAP, ACT, and SPT, together with the current constraints, just to highlight that there has really been a lot of progress recently, and that the constraints on the tensor to scalar ratio have improved by about an order of magnitude, and that NS has also improved significantly, and that by now we really know at high confidence that NS is close to one, but not exactly one. So this is what I was mentioning on the previous slide. And then I'll also just show you the other constraints that are related to the statements I made on two slides ago in a more quantitative way. The first one is a constraint on the running. So the fact that there's no indication that there's any running of the spectral index tells you that it's consistent with a power law for now. Here, these are the constraints on non-Gaussianity that I'm showing for the simplest or most traditional shapes. These are also all consistent with zero, and so the fluctuations are consistent with just Gaussian fluctuations. And here I'm just showing you the spatial curvature. Obviously, there's many other parameters that one can constrain from the data. And so given that this is what we've seen, one might ask, well, what do we then expect for the gravitational wave signal? And so here, what one can do is one can try to take the observed value of the spectral index seriously and say that the departure from one or from exact scale invariance is small, or that smallness is controlled by the one large parameter we have in the theory, which is the number of e-folds counted from the end of inflation. It could be an accident, so you can easily write down models where accidentally you get a nearly scale invariant spectrum with the right red spectrum with a small departure from one. But it could be that it points at something more general that suggests that really we're seeing this value because the spectral index as a function of n has this form. It's just one minus some order one number divided by n. Then the first slow roll parameter in general, as long as it's small, satisfies a differential equation like this. If one then substitutes in this functional form for the spectral index, one finds that the spectral index, not the spectral index, the slow roll parameter as a function of n should be of this form, where n equality is just the integration constant that comes with solving the equation. And typically, if there are no additional large hierarchies, we would expect that to be order one. Then you see that there's two regimes here. One is where the first term dominates. The other one is where the second term dominates, if we're away from the special point where n is of order and this integration constant. And so then that means that either you would expect the scalar spectra, the slow roll parameter, to be just some constant over n. You can show by integrating that the potential that is associated with that is associated with a monomial potential, at least during inflation. The F potential would be described in this way. And of course, near the minimum, you expect there to be a quadratic minimum, and then just during inflation it's described by this monomial. The other option is when you're in the opposite regime, then the slow roll parameter is of this form, which just scales like 1 over n to the p plus 1. And you can again derive what the potentials look like. And it turns out that in this case, the potential is either of a hilltop form where the potential has a maximum at the origin and the field rolls down from there, or a plateau potential where it approaches a constant as the field value goes to infinity. This just depends on whether p is greater than or less than one. And so we can look at the two models or what we know about them. The first one is the class of the monomial models. This makes a prediction that's shown here in the dark blue. And this is, you might say, is excluded by the current data. I'm just saying it's about to be excluded because really the models that are up here, so that predict the larger tensor to scalar ratio, I think those are fairly robustly excluded. I mean, I have no reason to suspect anything that would modify that prediction. And we just have constraints from Bicep Keck in combination with Planck that rules out these models. Where one should be a little bit careful is the models on the side here that are just ruled out by the measurements of the scalar spectral index, because the prediction assumes that there's just a single inflaton in the context of string theory, there are often additional degrees of freedom that actually then modify the prediction for the spectral index. So as long as you're just ruling them out by the spectral index, there are still some model dependence, the ones that are ruled out based on the tensor to scalar ratio. They're just ruled out, and in particular, as everyone knows, the famous M squared phi squared model that people consider to be the simplest model of inflation for a long time, that's ruled out, unless you then add non-minimal coupling or do something else to the model. The second class of models, the hilltop models or plateau models, come with a characteristic scale over which the potential departs from a constant. So we have some value here, and then it drops and goes toward the minimum. And there's some scale associated with that, which I call the characteristic scale. And this is related to this integration constant. So the statement that we don't expect this integration constant to be a large or a small number is the same as saying that we don't expect to be a new scale in the problem, and we expect the characteristic scale to be around the Planck scale in the simplest models. That's not always true. So you can certainly have additional hierarchies and make this as small as you like, but typically a natural expectation would be that it's of order in Planck. And these are the kind of models that provide interesting targets for future experiments. So you see that if you have a characteristic scale around the Planck scale, this is in the region of the plot that will be probed with the next set of CMB experiments. Here is just a schematic plot of what it looks like in omega, the quantity that Tom fortunately introduced. I didn't introduce it here. So you just see the signal. Well, I'll say a little bit more about the transfer function toward the end. But so the reason it goes up here is just because this is where these modes enter during matter domination. These enter during radiation domination. It's just so that during radiation, the ones that enter during radiation domination largely give a scale invariant contribution, except for the small change coming from the tensor spectral index, which makes it slightly red. And so you see that at least in the immediate future, the only way to look for this particular signal is the cosmic microwave background. So I'll focus on that, and then the other experiments will come in when we talk about the phase transitions and the cosmic strings and so on, where the CMB won't really have that much to say. So here is just some of the current set of experiments that is looking for the signal. This should be, I mean, this is a transition now, but obviously this is not 2021. This is Bicep-Keck SPT that everyone knows. SPIDER is a balloon experiment that took one round of data, published their results. I think they will fly again. There's Polar Bear, the class experiment, Advanced ACT. So there's a range of experiments. And just to see what they're trying to measure, what remains left to be done for the CMB, I think it's useful to just show a plot that shows all the angular power spectra in the same plot. So then we see that in the temperature power spectra have been measured by Planck about as well as you can measure them, because eventually there's the unresolved galactic foregrounds that are a problem to won't be able to really measure this tail in temperature. One can extend it a little bit beyond Planck, but not much. In polarization, the situation is different. So Planck provided us with a very nice measurement here, but you see that there isn't anything measured at high signal to noise out here on the tail. And it looks a little bit small because I'm showing this as a log-log plot, but in fact, the number of modes goes like 2L plus 1, so there are actually more modes here overall to be extracted from the polarization data than have been extracted from the temperature data so far. So there's still quite a bit of information left to be extracted in the CMB from the small-scale measurements. And then on large scales here, Planck provided a measurement of the E modes, but it was very challenging in part because of unexpected systematics. And so this is something that eventually will have to be remeasured. And in addition, we're trying to, of course, most relevantly for the talk, look for the gravitational wave signal, for which we don't really know the amplitude. We have some idea of the shape, but we don't really know the amplitude. But as I was just arguing, for the simplest models where we expect it to be around this value or larger. And so overall, there's still a lot of information left. Now we'll focus on the gravitational B-modes here. And just to explain a little bit why the experiments look the way they will look, I wanted to highlight again that there's the two different regimes. There's the large-scale polarization, which we'll try to search for with telescopes that look approximately like this. So this is one of the designs for CMBS4, and also this is modeled after the Bicep Keck series, except that here there are three of these optics tubes in one cryostat. But that's the basic setup. And the gravitational waves, really a pristine relic of the primordial universe. They don't interact with much. And as I already mentioned, in the foreseeable future, the imprint on the CMB is the only way to see them, because they're independent from the density perturbations. If we see them, it will be exciting. The small-scale polarization also is quite interesting because it constrains the number of relativistic species. In fact, this also provides a somewhat weak bound on the gravitational waves on small scales because they contribute to relativistic species at some level. It's not interesting in the simplest models of inflation, but if you have something more interesting where you produce more of them, then there are some bounds that you can put also from these measurements. It constrains the sum of neutrino masses, dark matter properties, dark energy, and of course also the statistical properties of the primordial density perturbations. Here we're focused on the gravitational waves. So even there, it turns out that we actually need both the small aperture telescopes and the large aperture telescopes, because if you look at the signal, so here I'm showing you CL instead of the usual CL squared, L squared times CL, just because the noise spectra are easier to see there. And so here you see the gravitational wave signal, but you also see that it's buried in lensing B modes, so just B modes that arise from weak gravitational lensing of the E mode signal. And this is something that one can remove by having high precision observations of the E modes from the large aperture telescopes. And then one can arrive at a situation that looks like this and detect the residual gravitational waves with a combination of the large aperture and small aperture telescopes. So this was just to motivate why the experiments look the way they look. So there will be, for South Pole Observatory, there will be the small aperture telescopes in the style of Bicep Keck combined with SPT. Similarly, for Simons Observatory, there will be large and small aperture telescopes, and also be looking for gravitational waves from, among other things, from Chile. And then eventually the different groups will join forces and look for primordial gravitational waves and light relics, dark matter, and so on from the South Pole. This is basically the entire CMB community coming together for this kind of ground-based experiment. Then there will also be attempts to measure these from space. There's Lightbird, which is led by JAXA and is currently scheduled to launch in 2028. And we also worked on a more futuristic CMB satellite, high resolution. So Lightbird, I didn't want to go into too much details about the different experiments. Lightbird is relatively low resolution. This would be a high resolution satellite mission. And then here is what you can expect to come out of this set of experiments. Stage three is again the South Pole Observatory and Simons Observatory. If you combine them, you get constraints that look around like this, like these purple constraints, purple or pink. Then CMBS4, Lightbird will lead to constraints that look something like this. If you combine them, you can do slightly better. In fact, you can do better than you would have expected by just combining them, because you can use the CMB S4 measurements to delens Lightbird. So actually the sensitivity, if one does that, goes up significantly. So there's some complementarity there. Then there is in green the kind of reach that you would have with a more futuristic CMB mission. And so these will either detect the primordial gravitational waves from inflation or exclude the simplest models that naturally predict the scalar spectral index and have a super Planckian characteristic scale, which is the quantity I mentioned before. And so this is really, I think, the only way to look for it, unless there are additional things. So if we're going beyond the simplest models of inflation, I don't want to spend much time on it, but I want to just give two examples of what that could look like. So one example is where the inflaton is an axion, then it's natural to expect that there could be some coupling to gauge fields that looks like this. So some order one number over the axion decay constant times axion times FOHF. This leads to an instability in one of the polarizations of the gauge field. You can see it here. So there's one that comes with a minus sign. And C, this parameter C, is just alpha times phi dot over 2FH. And so if this parameter is here in these figures, you see one example of 2.66, one of 2.33. So if the coupling has the right values, if it's obviously if it's too large, it's already ruled out because it predicts things we didn't see in the CMB. But if it's small enough to not be seen in the CMB, you can still achieve a signal that is detectable with either LISA or the ground-based detectors. So this is one of the ways that one could make it observable. Another scenario is where you just have large density perturbations. On the CMB scales, this is, the spectrum is, of course, tightly constrained and small. But and as we said, it's a power law that's nearly scale invariant. But observationally, it really could be much larger because we have no very good constraints on small scales. So there could be processes like, so the power spectrum in the density perturbations goes like one over the slow roll parameter. So if that, or one over phi dot squared, if you want. And so if phi dot slows down at some point, becomes small, then you can enhance the density perturbations on the scale, on the scales that that exit the horizon around that time. Similarly, if you were to change the sound speed of the inflaton, you can have features there. If you have a sharp turn in field space, features in the potential. So there are various ways that you can, on small scales, have some features in the primordial power spectrum. It's not the thing that you expect in the simplest models, but if you have some extensions, that is, then it's not too crazy to think that there could be some peak. Somewhere you could have two phases of inflation. So there are various ways of getting enhanced density perturbations. And then these, of course, generate gravitational waves at second order. And so the upper limits on the stochastic gravitational wave background also constrain features in the spectrum of primordial density perturbations on scales where we otherwise don't have a probe. And in particular, if these density perturbations are large enough to form black holes, meaning that when the modes re-enter the horizon, the perturbations collapse and form black holes, then there is a stochastic gravitational wave background expected from this second order process, and also potentially separately from the binary in spirals and mergers. And this is also something that could be seen with LISA or the ground-based experiments. But again, it takes going beyond the simplest models of inflation to see something like this, but at least it's logically a possibility. And these are things that are really gonna be constrained just by having these observations. I also want to say a few words just about the aftermath of inflation. So there are different scenarios. Again, I'll just show two because I find them entertaining. So one is a scenario where at the end of inflation, objects that are known as oscillons form. So here you have the potential that away from the minimum might be described by a power law. Here in this case, what I'm showing is actually linear potential associated with a axion monodromy models, but it's not really too relevant. The only thing that's relevant is that it flattens out relative to a quadratic potential as one goes to large field values. And then the self-couplings and the inflaton lead to parametric resonance at the end of inflation, assuming that the field doesn't already decay into other things. That means that the field breaks up and forms oscillons. And I'm just showing you a little movie that we made for a paper we wrote quite a while ago. And so here you see these structures form. And eventually you see they become round. And so the oscillon dynamics itself typically, although one can also play with that, but typically doesn't lead to a large amount of gravitational waves, but the production actually does lead to a sizable signal. Let me just wait until they're done oscillating. So these are these oscillons, or the energy density in these objects. And then the spectrum of gravitational waves that's produced looks something like this. So it's not terribly small, but the frequency is really kind of high. And we'll see that there's a good reason for this. So this is the difficulty. I'm just showing it in case anyone comes up with a good idea of detecting gigahertz gravitational waves. But that's the problem with the things that happen at the end of inflation. This is just a generic feature. So the other process is the preheating, where it's not the self-couplings of the field, but coupling to other fields that lead to parametric resonance. So the simplest example is where you have your inflaton that has a quartic coupling to some spectator field, could have a mass, might not have a mass, obviously will be better if it doesn't have a mass, so this term entirely dominates. But if you have this, you get, as the inflaton oscillates at the bottom of the potential, you get an oscillatory piece here, which triggers parametric resonance in the chi field and produces the chi field. And this leads also to gravitational waves. And again, the spectrum is not terribly small, but it's, again, in a frequency range that just seems difficult to detect. And this is really just, you can see from just dimensional analysis, if you're trying to estimate what the frequency is, it's set by the gravitational waves at the production are set by the mass of the inflaton, because that's what sets the oscillations. This is of order the inflationary Hubble rate. And we also know that the scales that we're usually constraining, K star, this is the pivot scale that exits the horizon 60 EFOLs before the end of inflation. So if we want to know what the scales are, or frequencies are associated with the end of inflation, we just multiply by e to the 60 and we get a frequency that corresponds to 300 megahertz or above for these kind of processes. And so this is obviously far out of reach for upcoming detectors. I was just showing it because I think the physics is nice, and maybe someone has an interesting idea of looking for these things. I don't really, but maybe someone else has a better idea how to look for this. Now let me move on and talk about first order phase transitions as another possible source. So here I think everyone also knows this picture. The idea of the first order phase transition, or first order phase transition, happens in field theory if at some temperature above the critical temperature there's a single minimum for the effective potential and near the origin, and then as the temperature drops to a critical temperature, a second minimum appears that becomes degenerate with the one at the origin at this temperature. And it's separated from the other. So there's two separate ones that are separated by a barrier. And as the temperature drops further, the second minimum becomes the true minimum. And eventually, there's a phase transition that proceeds through nucleation of bubbles of the true vacuum inside the false vacuum that before was where the field was. And so here I'm just, again, to give you some sense, showing you a little animation that will show the kinetic energy density in the scalar field in blue, or this will show you the scalar field dynamics. And then the red parts is, you see the gravitational wave production from this process. And so you just see that the bubbles expand and eventually collide and produce gravitational waves. And in fact, it's not just the bubbles colliding, but it's also the subsequent scalar field dynamics that produces gravitational waves, as you can see. So you see the gravitational waves form in this little movie. So that's the picture you should have in mind for the first order phase transition. And so then more quantitatively, what are the sources? Well, they are the sources from the bubble collision and the scalar field dynamics that I just described. So this is associated with just the di dj or di phi dj phi piece in the stress tensor. And if the transition occurred in a vacuum, this would be all there is. But in cosmology, typically we assume that it it occurs in a medium. So there's the universe is filled with a plasma, and so during the phase transition, these particles are also around. This means that as these bubbles expand, they actually generate sound waves, and the dynamics of those sound waves also produces a gravitational wave spectrum. This is associated with the stress tensor for the just perfect fluid here. In addition, if there's magnetic fields around, either they're already around in terms of primordial magnetic fields, or they're generated during the phase transition through charge separation, then you may also have a scenario where MHD turbulence becomes important, which would source gravitational waves through this part of the stress tensor. So there are several sources, and it depends which one dominates, depends on which regime you're in, or what range, what the parameters are of your particular theory. We should again estimate the frequency, so we don't end up in the situation that we ended up with the scenario after inflation, where it looks interesting, but the frequencies are where we can't really see anything. So here, the frequency is set roughly just by Hubble rate, by the Hubble rate at the usually when there's the little H star. This is the Hubble rate at the completion of the phase transition. For us, it doesn't matter too much exactly how we're defining it. So this is just the Hubble rate around the time of the phase transition. And I'll put a greater than or a twiddle here, because it's not literally Hubble. We know that these are causal processes, so there will be some sub-Hubble scales that that are responsible for setting the frequency. And so from this initial frequency, it then just redshifts, so we just get this h times a redshift factor. And if we just very crudely assume that it happens during radiation domination and approximate h by t squared over m Planck, and say we can just ignore any changes in the relativistic degrees of freedom, and just say that we can approximate this factor by the ratio of the CMB temperature to the temperature which the phase transition occurs. And then you see that the gravitational waves should have a frequency of 2 × 10⁻⁵ Hertz if the temperature is around a TeV, which is a much better frequency range than the one we just looked at. And in fact, it's a little bit better, at least for LISA, because as I said, the features in the spectrum are really set by some sub-horizon scales, not literally Hubble. For example, if the production is dominated by the sound waves, it's set by the sound shell thickness. It could be set by the average bubble separation, depends a little bit, but all these scales are sub-Hubble scales, and so there's a parameter that characterizes the ratio of the sub-horizon scale that sets the frequency to Hubble. That appears here. That's it's often written in this way, and then typical parameters could be a tenth or a hundredth or somewhere in this range. And so, if you have a scenario like this, then a phase transition at a TeV generates a stochastic gravitational wave background with a peak frequency in the millihertz range. And so, this is what makes it exciting, because we know that there's a phase transition around the TeV scale. We think it's not first order, but it could be in extensions. And so LISA will really probe this kind of physics around the electroweak scale, which is exciting. And more generally, I think it's important to note that the gravitational wave observations really cover an interesting frequency range, because they extend all the way from the QCD scale for the pulsar timing arrays to the electroweak scale with LISA to 10⁸ GeV or so with LIGO, where you could have phase transitions associated either with axions, or you could have phase transition associated with leptogenesis, or you could just have phase transitions in the dark sector that we're completely unaware of from the perspective of the standard model. So there are potential signals. There are no guaranteed signals, no obvious targets, but it's at least a very interesting range of frequencies.
But, I think there is a question.
Okay.
Rafael, this is Ghazal. Can you remind me again, what was the frequency range for Acylon case?
For the Acylon, it's really the frequency is just set by the Hubble rate at the end of inflation. So it would be something like 10 to the 13 GeV or so.
In hertz?
I mean, depends on the model.
Yeah, and in hertz?
Oh, gigahertz. It's around gigahertz.
Gigahertz. Okay. And this is after the 4DE folding of redshifting after inflation.
This is today. So today it would be, so the wavelength of these things are of order a meter. And so they have around 30 centimeters. So they have around frequency of around gigahertz today.
Okay, so we would need like tabletop kind of experiment, very, very small.
Yeah. So this would be tabletop experiments. There are some papers where there's an idea to use the axion cavity searches or cavity searches for axions to look for these gravitational waves, but they're just really not anywhere near sensitive enough. I mean, you're off by many orders of magnitude compared to the sensitivity that you would want. So right now, I think there isn't a good idea to look for the cosmological signals in that frequency range. But I just pointed it out because there's an interesting signal there. We do think there's something there if inflation happened. But I don't know how to get down to the kind of sensitivities that one would need for, yeah, but it's in the gigahertz range. Any other questions? If not, then I guess let's continue with the phase transitions and let's just say we could take any particular particle physics model and for that particle physics model really predict what the gravitational wave spectrum should look like. But typically that's not what's done. So typically we just parameterize the phase transition by a few phenomenological parameters. One I already showed was the Hubble rate at the completion of the phase transition. Then there's the strength of the phase transition, which in practice typically means the latent heat in units of the radiation density at the time. Then there, or the, I can also think about it as the difference in the potential energy density for the scalar fields that I was showing. Then there's the speed of the transition, the bubble wall velocity, and then the fraction of energy transferred into the sound waves, or also, if you're interested in the MHD case, the fraction of the energy transferred into MHD turbulence. And these parameters are then usually obtained for a given microscopic theory through matching typically matching to the 3D effective field theory and then doing numerical simulations. Here we go. And so then here I'm just showing one particular example of a phase transition at 100 GeV with parameters that are shown here. In this case, you're really dominated by the sound waves. This is what people typically expect, just because they keep going on after the phase transition. So there's the dynamics can generate gravitational waves for a while and dominates the other signal signals, except on very large and higher and very low frequencies for LISA. And you see that at least for these parameters, it's comfortably within reach of LISA. These are different LISA configurations. None of them is actually the configuration that looks like will fly, but we're somewhere in the middle there. And so, as I said, unfortunately, in the standard model, there are no first-order phase transitions expected. And so we don't have any obvious targets to look for, but they do occur in extensions that are not really entirely unreasonable. For example, if you have a two Higgs doublet model, you can be in a regime where you have a first order phase transition, or you can have extensions of the standard model by singlets, or also by a singlet with a Z2 symmetry. And what makes it interesting is that these kind of extensions, certainly extensions by a singlet, are kind of difficult to probe at the LHC. And so the gravitational wave observations are really complementary in interesting ways to the accelerator constraints on the energy at TeV energies. And of course, as I said, the first order phase transitions could also occur at higher or lower energies, for example, could be associated with the generation of right-handed neutrino mass or with axions, or it could just be something in the dark sector that we don't really know much about. So there's several ways of having phase transitions. And so I think the constraints will actually really be quite interesting and informative for early universe physics. Then let's move on to the defects. And here I'm showing you the prototypical example of an abelian Higgs model. So we just have a Mexican hat potential. And if you have a Mexican hat potential like this, you can end up in a scenario where in one part of the universe, the scalar field rolled down to this side during the phase transition. And then as you go around some point in space, the field might wind around in the vacuum manifold. That means that as you now go to the point that you wound around somewhere, it has to then sit at the top of the hill, meaning that there's some lump of energy density here, which is a cosmic string in this case. This is just one of the examples. More generally, if you have a symmetry group G that's broken to an unbroken subgroup H, you get stable defects or you get domain walls if pi zero of your coset of G mod H of the vacuum manifold is non-zero. You get strings if pi one is non-zero, monopoles if pi two is non-zero, and then you can have textures which are somewhat different but also interesting if pi three is non-zero. And you can have metastable defects even if the homotopy groups vanish. I'll show one example of that at the end. For example, you can have strings that can break because there's monopoles. So this is something that then isn't topologically stable but can still have interesting observational consequences. And I should stress, because I was focused on first order phase transitions now, that this holds regardless of the order of the phase transition. And so the picture you should have in mind here, I'm talking about cosmic strings, but some of the things I'm saying really are more general. So I can try to highlight that, although I may forget. But so after the phase transition for cosmic strings, you should imagine being left with some network of strings that looks kind of like this. So you have some long strings, you have some loops. And if there were no interactions, then, and I should say when I say long strings, when I say that they scale like 1 over a squared, I really mean strings that have a length that's large compared to Hubble. So they would here maybe stretch through the box, but I really just mean that they're large compared to Hubble. And in the absence of any interactions, the infinite strings or the long strings, their energy density you can easily scale as C scales like 1 over a squared. The energy density in the loops just scales like 1 over a cubed. And so they would rapidly begin to dominate the energy density of the universe if there are no interactions. So that's not the picture you should have in mind. Instead, you should have in mind a picture where these strings actually interact. And it turns out for the abelian Higgs model, for example, these interactions are very efficient. So the probability for these to inter-auto commute is essentially one. And so when these strings meet like this, they form closed loops. So also when they self-intersect, they can emit a loop. And this means the network of the long strings is losing energy by emitting the loops, which means it then redshifts faster than 1 over a squared. Similarly, the smaller loops can also decay through self-intersections further and again lose additional redshift faster. And these processes are expected or can lead to what is known as a scaling solution. So here, what that means is that if we're looking at the energy density of the strings, we can define some characteristic scale that is defined. So if you take a box of size L or linear size L, then the L is chosen so that the total length of string inside the box is also L. Then the total energy in the box is the tension times the length of string divided by the volume, which just gives you mu over L squared. the scaling solution then is the statement that this length scales like T, which means like the only scale in the problem, like 1 over Hubble or the horizon distance. And so the energy density goes like mu times h squared, or in particular goes like 1 over T squared, which is the same as the energy density in radiation, which also scales like 1 over T squared, or at later times the energy density in matter also scales like 1 over T squared. And so these the energy density in the strings just scales, and the ratio of the energy density in the strings to the energy density in radiation is constant, and during matter domination, the energy density of the strings to the energy density in matter is constant. So that's the picture you should have in mind. And so this is just another way of showing this, taken from this paper, where you have some initial, the long strings that formed here, the blue ones are also strings that formed at early times. And then there are all the little red loops that that formed through the processes that we described. And then during radiation domination, the energy density and all this stuff scales like 1 over 8 to the fourth, and it's proportional to the energy density in radiation. And it turns out that the dynamics of these loops generates, it's relatively easy to see, but I didn't want to go through the algebra here, is that this generates a scale invariant gravitational wave background. And this is one of the aspects that's more general. So it's not just true for strings that are scaling, but it's also true for any other type of defect that can be in this kind of scaling regime. They always then generate a scale invariant gravitational wave spectrum or at high frequencies. More quantitatively, you can just write down the contribution of the closed loops to the energy density at a given frequency. And of course, they contribute the number density of these strings times the power they radiate at a given length. And then you just have to integrate over all the length, or so different lengths of strings. And you have to redshift it and integrate over time. So this is the contribution to the energy density from these strings, where again, this is the loop number density. And this is the power these strings or strings at length L on average emit at a given frequency. Here, this is just because if we want the frequency to be F today, then it had to be higher at early times. So there's this redshift or blue shifting factor. Here, there's no controversy. The controversy comes about because there's different groups that don't really agree what the number density should be. Here I'm showing the two proposals for the loop number density for the strings by the two groups. So here's the first group is the green one, and then the blue line, which obviously has many more small loops, is the group that I'm showing here. And often it's phrased as a disagreement between two sets of numerical simulations. I don't think that's really how you should think about it. It's just, I think, more how the simulations are actually used. For example, the first group early on was measuring not the loop number density, but was measuring the loop production function, which means it's the time derivative for how many loops are produced in a Hubble volume in a Hubble time. And they find that strongly peaks during radiation domination at a size of about a 20th of the Hubble scale. And given that they see this peak, which is consistent with the one scale model that was used by Vilenkin, for example, you can then infer what the loop number loop density should be, and you get a function that looks like this. The other group, instead of measuring the loop production function directly, measured the number density and used an analytic model for the loop production function and extracted the parameters for that loop production function from large scales where you can trust the simulations and where they actually agree, and then used that loop production function to extrapolate to smaller scales, and in doing that, get a much higher prediction for the loop density for small loops. And one obvious question is, what would happen? So this group subsequently actually measured the loop number density also from their simulations, and they argue that it's consistent with what they have. For the second group, I think, or to the best of my knowledge, we haven't yet seen a measurement directly of the loop production function, and we don't know if it's consistent with the analytic approximation that goes in, or would also be strongly peaked at some scale like was seen in these simulations. So there's some there's a paper, though, by this group that discusses the different loop production functions, but as far as I can tell, without a measurement from the simulations at this point. So there's this discrepancy, which then obviously translates into large disagreements on what the spectrum should look like. So the red or pink type curves are from the, I should have maybe used the same colors, but this is the BOS model, often called the BOS model, is the one that's shown here. And then here is the second group. And then here are the different constraints. So there's too much really going on in this plot. But you see, of course, that on small scales, this is the kind of scale invariant spectrum that we were discussing. And then during from the loops that radiate during the matter-dominated period, you have contributions down here. There's this peak from the loops that are formed during radiation domination, but still radiate during matter domination. And then there's a tail from the loops that form during matter domination and radiate during matter domination. And then you see the sensitivity of the different experiments to the to this kind of signal. And you see that with pulsar timing arrays, eventually one may probe G times mu, which again is the string tension in Planck units, which gives you a sense of the energy scale of inflation. So you should take the square root to find the ratio of the energy scale of the phase transition in Planck units. You can probe down to 10 to the minus 13 for pulsar timing arrays, down to around 10 to the minus 15 in the LIGO range, and then down to 10 to the minus 17 with LISA. And so this is the basic picture. This is for the numbers I was quoting are for the BOS model. Obviously, the bounds would be much tighter if the other model were correct. And then I'm just showing the plots here, but the little lines here for nanograph in IPTA. But we don't really, I think, yet know whether these are gravitational waves or what they are, and certainly not whether they are associated with cosmic strings. I just wanted to put them on the plot. Then, as I said, there's the possibility that these strings are not really stable, but metastable. And then the decay, of course, means that they aren't around at late times, which is where I said the low frequency part of the spectrum is coming from. So this would really erase the low frequency part of the spectrum if you have these decaying strings. And you should still be looking for them, even if you didn't see them in one of the experiments. They can still show up in experiments at higher frequencies. So it's not that you have to necessarily see them everywhere. So this is all I wanted to say about the cosmic strings. Let me see, I don't see the time here.
You have about 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay, so I'll try to hurry up a bit. So this is the last part, the discussion of, let's imagine that we see a gravitational wave background. What other information is there? It's actually quite interesting, I think, because it's there are a number of effects that one could see if we had either a nearly scale invariant gravitational wave spectrum from inflation or one from cosmic strings, so something where we have an idea what the spectrum should look like, because there's both what I'm calling kinematic effects just from the expansion of the universe and then dynamic effects from anisotropic stress in the matter. The kinematic effects are easy to see. So if you are turning off for now the matter contributions, then on small scales, you can just use a WKB approximation. You have gravitational waves that are described in this way, which I'm just the only thing I'm using is that this scales like 1 over A. This just comes from the WKB solution. So the strain that we see today in the gravitational waves is the strain at creation or horizon entry for inflation, redshifted by 1 power of the scale factor, where A sub k is the scale factor at the time the mode with co-moving momentum k enters the horizon. So it's defined by this equation. And during radiation domination, we know that Hubble scales like, well, they always scales like 1 over t, which during radiation domination means it scales like 1 over t squared, a squared, which means that a k goes like 1 over k. This is the transfer function that we were looking at earlier, or k times the transfer function is the thing that's invariant. Then during matter domination, it scales like 1 over 8 to the 3 halves, which means that a k scales like 1 over k squared, so that even if you have a primordial spectrum that's scale invariant, then you get these features in omega GW. This was the explanation for the kink in the plot, as many people I'm sure know. And then it doesn't have to be just the power law, because there are periods where degrees of freedom freeze out. So for example, E plus E minus annihilates, and then the entropy that was stored in E plus and E minus has to be transferred to the rest of the photons. And this means that the expansion rate actually drops more slowly than it would otherwise, which means that the modes that were created before the freeze out actually have more time to decay, and they're more suppressed. So you get even if you have a scale invariant spectrum to begin with, you get features associated with the annihilation or freeze out of different species of particles. Here I'm showing you the contribution from E plus E minus. Here's what the plot would like for this look like for the standard model degrees of freedom. So you have E plus E minus, then here you have the muons and the pions, the QCD phase transition, obviously in some really crude approximation, and then here the other degrees of freedom in the standard model. And you would also see if there's supersymmetry, additional contribution. So there's interesting imprints, I guess, in the gravitational wave spectrum if we had such a spectrum. Then there's also the dynamic effects, as I was mentioning. The most famous one is the neutrino anisotropic stress comes from the free streaming of neutrinos, and is really generated around horizon entry. So because I'm kind of out of time, I'm rushing this a bit otherwise. So y here is really just the scale factor in units of the scale factor at matter radiation equality. And then you can see that there's a suppression. So zero would mean no suppression. And then here you see that around the time when this variable, which is kappa or some the wave number and units of the wave number that enters during radiation matter radiation equality times y of order one, is where this effect is active and really damps the gravitational waves. It also gives it a phase shift. And so without the neutrino anisotropic stress, you get the kind of curve I was showing. If you include the effect of neutrino anisotropic stress, the transfer function would look like this. So the scales where the neutrinos are still tightly coupled to the standard model, there's no free streaming degrees of freedom. Everything is tightly coupled. And in principle, there's a contribution from shear viscosity, but it's too small for anything to be relevant. And then here there is a dip once the neutrinos begin free streaming, there's a suppression. It's at an interesting scale, but somehow slightly, unfortunately, just out of the range of the pulsar timing arrays, unless we wait a really long time. There's other interesting effects. As I said, the shear viscosity of the medium leads to some amount of damping. In principle, also the anisotropic stress of dark matter leads to an index of refraction. This is really also too small for the typical cold dark matter models, and you have to go beyond the simple cold dark matter models to try to do anything with it. There's also, if you have in the dark sector, you have bound states, the tidal polarizability in principle also induces some index of refraction for the gravitational waves, but these are all really very small effects. There's the kinetic decoupling, which we discussed, and then also for the kinetic decoupling of dark matter, in principle, also leads to damping of gravitational waves. So here I'm showing you this effect. This is unfortunately suppressed by the energy density in the dark matter. The kinetic energy density in the dark matter relative to the total energy density in the dark matter at the time of kinetic decoupling, which for cold dark matter by definition is small. So this will also be a very small effect. And there's additional effects, but there's a lot of these kind of effects that maybe is a little embarrassing to discuss because they're so small. But at the time when the CMB was first detected, it would have also seemed crazy to discuss nanokelvin measurements of the CMB, which is what is happening now. So maybe one day we get to play with these kind of features if first we detect a stochastic gravitational wave background. So just to summarize, there really are many processes that could have taken place in the early universe to produce a stochastic gravitational wave background. The CMB observations will detect or constrain primordial gravitational waves from inflation, and the pulsar timing arrays, ground and space-based gravitational wave observatories, will cover a very interesting range of parameters for first-order phase transitions and defects, and they will constrain epochs that we cannot constrain otherwise. So I'm actually really looking forward to seeing this, and I'm not too depressed yet that LIGO doesn't see it. I'm happy to wait a little longer. So we'll see what happens. So anyway, that's what I wanted to say. And with that, let me just say thanks, and then see if there's any questions.
Thank you, Rafael. Any question from the online audience?
Yeah, I had a question. So thanks for the nice talk, Rafael. So you mentioned a while back in your talk about a gravitational wave background from primordial black holes, like if there was some phase transition or something like that that mm-hmm. caused primordial black holes. So I was wondering a bit about like how well the theoretical models of the expected gravitational wave signal are for that. So I guess my understanding was that just from the collapse of these rare overdensities, that was rather spherical. Because these peaks at the tail of the distribution would be very spherical, so that wouldn't give you a strong gravitational wave signal, but then you'd need these primordial black holes to merge to give you a gravitational wave. So can you say a little bit about
So there's two contributions. So one is just to produce the gravitational waves in the first place, you need primordial density perturbations that are large. And so then at second order, you generate gravitational waves just from that. So that part, I think, is well understood. I think the basic process goes back to an old paper by Tomita, and then the use of this, using gravitational waves to constrain primordial density perturbations, I think this goes back to Wands and collaborators. So that part is there. And then you're asking specifically about the gravitational waves. And I actually don't know that the constraints so certainly I think it would be nice to actually simulate this in GR and in numerical GR and actually see what's happening there, because there are certainly a lot of assumptions going into this, and then people make different assumptions as to how clustered these things are, and so there are certainly a lot of assumptions if you're asking specifically about the formation from the caused by the black holes, by the in spirals and mergers of the black holes. So I think the contribution from the second order contribution from the fact that the primordial density perturbations are large, I think that's more or less well understood. I think the contribution from the black holes would be interesting to study in more detail. That's, I think, the contribution you were asking about, right?
Yeah, I mean, would you expect those mergers to be like eccentric, or would it look like the standard quasi-circular ones that LIGO has seen? And
well, I don't know why they wouldn't be eccentricity in the beginning, but I really don't have very good intuition for even what the initial state after the formation of these black holes looks like. I mean, I don't know why they would have circular orbits right away, but I also haven't thought about this much.
All right, thanks.
Hi, Rafael, very nice talk. I have a couple of questions, but okay, maybe for the sake of time, I have to restrict to only one or two now. So okay. Are there any predictions about how the multi-band search can help in this paradigm? Like when you are showing from the cosmic strings, I saw that couple of the curves are already in the LIGO band pretty high, so we should be able to constrain it right now. And so
This depends on the scale of the energy scale of the phase transition, right? So the amplitude really is a free parameter. Oops, it is. Where did the stuff go?
Yes.
So you can think about it that way, but I think this just means the fact, yeah. So if you want to think about it that way, then LIGO already, if you think this is the correct model, that this loop production function that's being assumed here is correct, then LIGO is already constraining g mu of 10 to the minus 13 or so. So that this is, you can think about it that way.
So maybe I should. So what I was mainly asking is, because these particular signals goes across a long range of bands, are there any predictions about how multi-band measurement can help this? Like if I combine, say, LIGO or ET with LISA or PTA, are there any predictions about how deep we can go in the measurements of this G mu term?
If you just combine, I mean, I would suspect, because the sensitivity, I mean, if you just look at these curves and then you conclude that, let's say, the upper limit from LISA, let's say, is 10 to the minus 17, then I think it wouldn't necessarily, in just the sensitivity sense, help you to add bands that are two orders of magnitude less sensitive. So I think in that sense, it doesn't help. But of course, if you just see something that runs through the LISA band in this way, so let's say you see something in the LISA band, then you don't immediately know that these are cosmic strings, right? You have no idea what it is you actually just saw a priori. And so in that sense, it would help to actually see the spectrum. So I think for that, the spectral information would be interesting. I'm not sure that it immediately helps you with placing upper limits if you don't see anything. It helps if they're of similar sensitivity, but if you have different ones that are quite discrepant in the sensitivity to GMU, then I'm not sure that it helps you in terms of raw sensitivity. But once you see something, I think you would hope to see the shape of the spectrum. And I think for that, the multi-frequency observations would be interesting. But other people may have thought about this more. So,
Thanks.
Hi, I'm Shammi. So my question is, you showed various theories which can lead to this primordial gravitational wave generations. So I'm not sure if it's too early to ask this question. So with gravitational waves observations, say in future, if you don't see primordial gravitational waves, or if you see a certain pattern from that, you can definitely draw constraint on those theories. Do you think those constraints are going to be better for any of those theories compared to other experiments or observations?
Yeah, for example, for the cosmic strings, I don't think we have a good handle on phase transitions at these energies. So again, this is the energy scale. It gives you a measure of the energy. So mu, let's call mu just the expectation value squared. So this gives you a ratio of V, the energy scale of that process, divided by M Planck squared. And so let's say we have 10 to the minus 14 to make a simple number. Then you would have 10 to the minus 7 for V over M Planck, which would give you an energy scale for the phase transition of 10 to the 12 GeV, and we don't really have good handles on any other handles on ways to probe phase transitions at 10 to the 12 GeV. So I think this really probes an interesting range of scales. Right now, the CMB bounds, which I didn't show because they're really not probing the gravitational wave production from the strings, but really the contributions to the density perturbations, they're around 10 to the minus 7. So right now, we're kind of starting to enter an interesting regime of phase transitions around the gut scale, but this pushes you down to energy scales of, let's say, 10 to the 11 GeV. And so you're really covering an interesting range of phase transitions as far as the energy scale is concerned. And I think we don't really have other ways of probing these phase transitions. So I think in that sense, it provides you information that you just really don't get from other experiments. And as I said, the interesting thing here is that this really doesn't even rely on the phase transition being first order. This just relies on defects forming during the phase transition. Then it depends on which group you're breaking. So you could be in a scenario where you're not seeing anything. But as long as you have some higher For many groups, I guess you would expect to see some form of defects, not necessarily always cosmic strings. And then monopoles are a little bit different, but let's say you could constrain textures. So I think this really provides complementary information to the information we usually get on phase transitions in the early universe, both first order directly through the gravitational waves, and then also second order phase transitions through the constraints on the defects.
I see. Thank you.
Sure. And then also for inflation, I guess, as I said, I mean, if we don't see anything, we're really constraining models that we also can't constrain in other ways. So pushing down the tensor to scalar ratio, I think, is quite interesting in the context of inflation as well. And it will make some people give up on the theory, others will not give up on it. But I think generally agreed that it's interesting to just know whether it occurred at some energy scale or is pushed below and really then gets pushed in a regime where one has to think more about how it started and so on.
Okay, so I guess let's thank Rafael again.